First, thank you so much for being here. Good day to be at a library. It's so humid out. And let's see, I want to start, I'll give a little bit of background information about how I got into this kind of topic and then get into some of the topic. There's actually so much information. I'm going to try to give an overview and touch on a lot of topics, so there'll be many unanswered questions. One of my disclaimers is that some of the information about the state names, when I was doing research, there's so many different answers to some of the, what does something mean? So it's not an exact science. And even that's just, a lot of it was information from online or books. A friend of mine who is Lakota, he would ask his elders what their name means, and it's different from what it says in a book. So unless you actually talk to a native person, you might not know exactly what it means. But it's kind of to get the conversation started, and some of them may be very accurate, but I'm not 100% sure. So that's part of the disclaimer. And then the other thing is that I'm not here to speak for native people, my interest, how I got interested in sort of learning about and starting to meet native people is from a couple of different angles. As Donna said, I have like an interest in all kinds of spiritual traditions around the world. I have my own path, which is where my name monk comes from. And but I part of why I got into interest in native peoples is that part of how I got my interest in learning about the U.S. state names is because of where we are. That this land is originally, still is, native people's land. So the colonists coming over here, it kind of changed the fabric of things. And that's some of what I'm going to talk about. It's kind of like the names and the places. I have a strong impact in how we see the world and how we do not see the world. Whether it's a place name or even personal names. I looked up, my birth name is Walter Edgar Harris. So I looked that up, and it took me a while, and I kind of figured out it means something like peaceful warrior, fortunate spear, protector of the land. So I thought, wow, that's pretty neat. So that's another reason I'm speaking about this, because I feel like it's very significant with what's going on in the world nowadays, with whether it's with the environment or what's called Mother Earth, and we read about loss of species, we read about pollution, the lack of clean water, clean air, so many things that people are familiar with. So part of looking at where the state names come from touches into that. And then politically or geopolitically, the amount of money that's spent on war is another loaded topic. But some of that you can see traced from the way the names have happened. So that these are still sort of ongoing things that are playing out. So I'm not trying to like prove a theory or give you a specific answer, but I'm just trying to raise awareness to say, look at how we've named things and how that might affect your consciousness nowadays. How many people are even familiar with, state names or even like where we are? Some people? Okay. All right. Have you done like research or just in general? Another way I got into this too was not only just wanting to know, that's part of why I call myself a Turtle Islander. It's because native people, this land to them is called, most native peoples, it's called Turtle Island. And there's a whole mythological origin story, which sort of very simplistically is the sky woman came out of the sky and landed on the back of the turtle. And the earth grew on the back of the turtle. So we're all really riding on the back of a turtle. And so I like the, as a poet, as a writer, I like the metaphor of that, the image of that, the reminder of that. And another thing that got me interested in native peoples and studies is that just reading little bits here and there, like in one of the books on the list, I had read that out in the Southwest, uranium, which is under the ground, is an attractor for lightning. And so, in a sense, that is part of bringing it has to do with the rain cycles. I don't know the science of it, but just that little tidbit. So that the digging up of uranium, which there's been a lot of, and which a lot of it has gone to munitions, and there's still a lot of toxic, there's a lot of toxic residue still being dealt with, especially in the Midwest and, you know, South Dakota and Kansas, I think. So it's a whole sort of vicious cycle of pollution and disrespect for the earth. But what made me was like, wow, here's a kind of information and knowledge of how things affect other things that I think a lot of us, we don't get that in school, like that uranium could bring the lightning and that affects the rain. And so the whole deeper understanding got me into reading more about Native peoples. So that, and also I would say too that, you know, you can approach these things from different topics, whether it's reading or, you know, actually meeting, you know, getting to know Native people. There's so many different angles, whether it's the history, the current affairs, music, poetry. It wasn't until I read an anthology about a lot of modern Native people. I think now like about 70% live in cities. So besides the fact that a lot of people think there are barely any Natives anymore, there's also the fact that now they're not all, you know, stereotypically living in teepees and you know, running around with headdresses and things, that they're actually, I think there's like 80,000 Native people in the New York City area. So there's a whole cultural thing here that's going on, and that's really, I feel, is important in what's going on in the world today. And I've heard Native people talk about the prophecies of nowadays being a time when people would start to look to Native people for answers. And, you know, when, again, the environment and what's going on seems to be one of the main, you know, so much disaster zones, and we're trying to repair things and fix things. So I see that as part of that prophecy coming true. You know, a lot of these people have answers that other parts of our science don't always have the answer. So there's that angle, and also the just trying to think what just went out of my head. Most like the environment, and I'll leave it at that for now. let's see, part of how I wrote this book, I did a lot of research about 12, 15 years ago, working on this book called Singing an Epic of Peace. And while I was driving, I don't know if you're a writer, sometimes you just get a little snippet. And so I was just driving some out east, and I wrote down Native America on a notepad. And that was like a key that opened the door. That got me into the whole researching of all the states. So that's a big chunk of the book. It's not the whole book, but that's a big chunk of the book. And I'm going to read a few poems during the talk. And I basically just, I researched all the 50 states and try to, in every state, you know, I gave some background and sort of typical facts about what states are known for, whether it's Georgia peaches or rubber from Ohio, and at least mention one Native people in every state, or, you know, what we call states, because it wasn't the U.S. has been kind of divvied up since then, since it was one, you know, one land. There are like about 565 federally recognized nations, and there's at least about 200 more. So as you were saying when you came in, you had asked a Native person about what to call people, and each nation has their own name for themselves. But what I have learned is that even Native America or American Indian are not even preferable anymore, for two reasons. One, they're not Indians. That was Columbus thinking he landed it in India, was going to India and landed here. And then Americans, there's some of the things that I found were that several meanings I found for America that I've learned. One that I looked up was called Amaruca, which had to do with some kind of Mayan or Aztec, like a plumed serpent. Of course, there's the Amerigo Vespucci story. And then another one I recently learned was Americua, with a K-U-A, is a Mayan language term for American continent, which means land of the four winds. And then another one I've heard from Native peoples is that the Latin roots are Ame and Rica, which means love of riches, which when you look at the way money rules, I think that makes a lot of sense. So whatever you go with there, the point is that I try to use the word nations or refer to the native peoples that respect what they call themselves. And also try to use the word nations, because as I learned, actually tribes is from Rome, a Latin word from Roman. It's like Roman political divisions. So the fact that people over here across the water are called tribes doesn't make sense. But, you know, there are a lot of books and a lot of native people that are still going to say tribes and Indians. So it's, some of it is semantical and, you know, not to the gist of maybe certain topics, but I feel it's important to, you know, try to be as accurate as possible and respect, you know, when I hear a native person say this is what they like to be called or what word they prefer, I find that's important to try to, you know, try to relay that. Some people don't know that, like the even our Constitution comes, a lot of it was patterned after the Haudenosaunee, which is the Iroquois nation. They have something you can look up called the Great Law of Peace. So the Constitution was taken from there, a lot of it, some European influence. But what was left out was several important things. One was the respect for women. Women basically rule the most native cultures. The women are the decision makers. The women, you know, the clan. A lot of the native people are matrilineal, by, you know, they go by their mother's side. So there's a definite more respect for the, you know, now we just sort of had, U.S. is just having like women's rights and feminism and all these things that are just happening. So I guess we're trying to catch up. Also the things about peace, and also I had read that the connection, which I find very telling, is the connection with the spirit world. That was an integral part of the native law of peace. It was respect for spirit. That's again a whole topic we could go on a sidetrack. Essentially, I would say that it's like a respect for different, you know, the trees and the animals, that whether you think they have a soul or there's some living principle to all these energies that we have lost. I recently, they were cutting down some trees in I live out in Selden, and they were cutting down some trees because they're going to doing some paving. And so I was very upset because I saw them just take out a tree. And so I called up, and they were going on and on about the, you know, oh, we're going to be repaving and we have to protect the infrastructure and this is progress. And it was kind of hard to deal with, because, I mean, it's not that big a neighborhood. It's not that big a neighborhood, and we're using big words like infrastructure. And I realized that the whole sense of respecting, you know, respecting a tree as a living being was not kind of in their psychology. So I think that's a huge effect as to how we see the world, and how we can try to respect more wherever it is, whether it's in your backyard, or whether you're an activist, or whether you just want to read and learn to find out something more. Some of the ways I think this kind of information can be applied. When I looked up the state names, I found that about 30 come from native peoples or the names, either the name of the people or a physical the area, literally like rivers, mountains, hills. My friend said to say that to remember that the names are not nouns, that they are verbs, and that there's an action to them. So, you know, a state like Ohio may be named after the Ohio River, but to just think of it as a noun is to limit your awareness, because not only is a river in motion and constantly changing, but there may also be like a whole kind of creation story or a whole cultural history that the river is part of the culture. What was I reading about? Anybody heard of the Gwich'in people? They are, I think they're in like some of the northernmost part of Canada, maybe. I'm not sure of the geography. But there's a certain kind of caribou that is sacred to their culture. The caribou is like sort of like the buffalo to the Lakota people. And the Shinnecock people out east, the whale, it was like a sacred, it's a sacred part of their, they do basically everything to help protect those people, to protect the caribou. So just saying a river is not, doesn't quite do it, but it helps to, you know, remember that it's part of a bigger picture. And the language, I had learned, my friend who's Lakota, he has a wonderful radio show. It's on every week, it's called First Voices Radio. And it's on WPKN. You can listen online. They have archives. And I think WBAI. And it's a wonderful show because he actually talks to people, you know, that are in the trenches, so to speak, or dealing with what's going on in today's world. So it's not just reading a history book. You'll get history, but you also find out what's going on nowadays. So it was interesting. I found that because some of the names may have different sources or different interpretations, it's a rough estimate, but I counted about 14 states named after water and about 8 states named after earth. So like Massachusetts is after the hills, hilly place. Montana, Utah are after mountains, or the Ute Indians is Utah. And then the rivers, there's Mississippi, Missouri, Nebraska, Tennessee, Ohio. I think Kentucky maybe has to do with a meadow, but I think, I don't know, meadows, don't they get fed by a lot of water? So maybe there's a meadow by the river. Connecticut is another river. So I found that very telling that here we have this sort of memory of these place names being named after, you know, nature. But look at the state we're in now, which is trying to preserve our water. And we're pretty lucky out here. I think a fair amount of people I know still do filter their water here. But at least it's not like radiated, it's not dealing with radiated poisoning like some of the, say, the Lakota in the Midwest. Again, because of the uranium mining, they have to try to get Geiger counters to see if their water is even okay to drink. So we have, you know, again, the water and the names of the places, the whole consciousness thing going on. Only 2 states that I found have the name after air or wind, which is Kansas and Arkansas. Arkansas being kind of like Arkansas. And then a few of them were named after people like Iowa, Oklahoma, Illinois, and Indiana. Louisiana, let's see, I'm trying to see where I got, that's King Louis, yeah. So that's another, thanks for the segue, because that's another, another angle is thing, basically, again, I'm not like a full scholarly historian, I get an idea, I want to write a poem or a story, and I start researching sometimes. So that's somehow I got into this. Then the other angle from these native names is we have the Spanish and the English and the French and all these and Russian, all these influences here. So a lot of the state names, interestingly, like just the other day I was looking up, seeing along the East Coast a lot of the English, which I think is part of why some of this stuff is so surprising, because on the East Coast we are not as connected with resource mining and extraction and things like that, and you know, we're not as close to that as a lot of places out west, where a lot more of the resources are. But there are a lot of rivers and protests and things still going on the East Coast, so that is happening. But on the East Coast, there's Georgia after King George, and Virginia after Queen Elizabeth, and Maryland after Mary, and Carolinas is King Charles. So what I notice is with that is we have this kind of this royalty thing going on, and you know, if you're into that whole thing, that's okay. But it's a very different view than a native perspective, because it's sort of this glorification of the individual. That's why on this on the handout I gave you, I put a quote by a native poet and speaker, Lila June Johnston. I was reading a book of hers. And she wrote, "We need more people who name themselves after the land instead of naming the land after themselves." So I think that's that kind of sums up the essence of what I see as like a consciousness shift. you know, where we to come to a place and it's this sort of cultural colonization domination thing is like, you know, I'm gonna name this after me. You know, and it's like a, you know, in a way, it's a big way, it's a disrespect for what's already here, whether it's a river or the people or whatever it is. And let's see, the other one, yeah, there's a bunch of Spanish names, Florida, California was a real mixed bag when I looked that one up. Mexico, New Mexico, that's kind of a no-brainer. Colorado, yeah, they say the color red. That's one of the... Arizona was another mixed... There's a bunch of answers I got. Some say like a little water place. Yeah, but when that's one. But some of the, if you look them up, there's other answers given. So I'll look that one up right now. See if I can find it. That's what I'm saying. Some of them, they, you know, these are some of them. When you look them up, like you can look them up online, and you'll see what little one-line answers for all these things. But when I researched farther, I would find sometimes two or five answers. So that's part of what I'm saying is a little bit of the confusion. Yeah, the other ones I found were from the Aztec Arizuma silver bearing, Arizona Pima Indian Arizonac. I don't know how to pronounce all these, but Ali Shonak Little Spring Place. So again, as you get into it, it gets sort of very, you know, nitpicky. Trying to find the information. Let's see, then the Georgia, Virginia, Vermont, a couple of French ones. Vermont, anybody know what Vermont means? Okay, so that's sort of like stands out to me because it's a colonization name, but it honors the mountain. So that's sort of like a midpoint. And Louisiana, too. Another name thing I noticed over the years, which again kind of ties into what I see as a kind of consciousness shift needed, is that we have all these New Jersey, New Hampshire, New York, New England, New Brunswick, it goes on, there's a whole thing. So this is not new, like this area, these places are not new. They are, a lot of the native cultures and the histories go back thousands and thousands of years. So it's kind of like this imprint, this kind of overlay that's been put on our, you know, on our awareness. So, I personally find the names to be, you know, I mean, I grew up in New York, but I don't find the names they're missing something because they're not including other things. And it's, you know, when I see ads that are like new and improved, I think of the states in a way. It's like, oh, here are people coming from somewhere else and naming here, just, you know, making new names. You know, I'm not trying to offend anybody's sensibility or respect for United States or try to blame. To me, it's just a matter of raising awareness about the names and the places because they do connect with people and there is a consciousness and a respect that goes with that that I think is important, especially nowadays, for people to get along better. And that's another thing I have heard about from the state, from Native people, as this is a time when things are so severe and so troubled that people do need to get along better. And so the kind of divisions of different, you know, nations and cultures and people, we need to get along. So that's also part of how I see that these names and the places can help raise some awareness as to bridge those gaps between, you know, what has been put, the names and that have been put on them and that we've grown up with, and other names that, you know, consciousness that's been here for thousands of years. All right, let me read, I picked out four poems to read, but I don't know if I'll get to them all. I wanted to read the Delaware one. So what I did was basically I took all the information and I studied the way some epic poems were written. And a lot of them were, some of them I looked at were rhyme after rhyme after rhyme. So I basically adopted like a quatrain format. Figured it would be more palatable if there's a little rhyme to it. And it's not always an exact, some of the lines are really long, it's not an exact rhyming. But I tried to put all the information I could find into a verse to make it a little more palatable. And before I forget, that book, I'm selling the book for $10 and all the money is going to either the Lakota people or the Shinnecock, which the Shinnecock are out east and partly because I have a Lakota friend, and also they have some of the poorest counties in the entire U.S. The poverty rates, the suicide rates, the alcohol, the poverty, the job, you know, just the statistics are like up in the 80-90%. Some of it is just really sad. So it's not like a pity thing. I figure like mostly South Dakota. Yeah, the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. Again, the names we in school learned as the Sioux, but that's not their true name. So, all right, I'll read. I don't know if I can pronounce. I might skip some of the names so I don't mispronounce them. But this is Delaware, which is the first state in 1787, and I called it the Grandfathers. The very first state, Delaware, from Delaware Bay and River, named for Sir Thomas West, Lord Delawarr, which is W-A-R-R, essentially war, but history adapted is the real Indian giver. Delaware Indians is the English name for a tribe here long before Europeans' arrival, with dugout canoes and bark-covered longhouses, Lenni Lenape, the people, genuine, common, real river people, well managed their own survival. Oh, I just want to say that when I was looking up the names too of the native nations or tribes, a lot of their names mean at least the basic translation is like the people, or the common people, or human beings, or just very basic generic names. I don't mean generic to like be demeaning, but again, it's sort of like the opposite of the colonial, you know, kings and queens. Stuff. So I found that interesting too. The Delaware River rolled through their lands, what are now parts of Maryland, Virginia, Washington, D.C., Pennsylvania, Ohio, Delaware, Ontario, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, Ohio, New York, and New Jersey, speaking different dialects of Algonquin, Lenni Lenape, the Unala, Chittigo, Unami, and Munsee. People near the ocean, totem turkey. People downriver, totem turtle. People of the stony country, totem wolf, all have overcome many a hurdle. How telling of the first state's name, a misnomer of the people's territory, attributed to a namesake, lord of the war, nothing personal, sir, and all that stealthy glory. You could stop right here and still know the gist of the following verses of historical rhyme, but the names and the people and their pathways worth knowing are listed below if you find the time. The Lenape, now primarily in Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Canada, after 130 years of moving westward and northward again and again, also known as the original people, grandfather, and men of men. The Lenape creation myth reportedly depicted with etched pictographs on bark and sticks, picked up on earth near flowing waters, creation ever burning on spiritual wicks. Also currently in Kansas, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Ontario, covering a range with a warbling sound akin to the little birds called vireo. To numerous tribes, they are the elders worth learning of if you bother, for if given the chance, would you not care to know the story of your dear grandfather? Anybody have any question or comment? I might start saving those for the end of it, but I'll pause to catch my breath if anybody's got a question.
So did you say Oreo was
a Native
American name?
Which one?
The bird. Did you say
Oreo? Oh, that's like how do you rhyme something? So I put that in.
V. I was thinking.
It's a V, a bird, V-I-R-E-O.
There's so few words that are integrated into common discourse besides the names of actual places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few. There's a few words we kind of adapted, you know, moccasins and... the other ones are escaping me, but let's see. Excuse me? Maine? That was I'll try to look it up. I forget. I'll check it later. I'll remember. I think I can. Let me see. I wanted to, just briefly in the blurb, it mentioned monuments and in the description of the talk, so I want to just touch on that briefly, like the monuments. Sometimes we see statues and monuments. That's a potentially loaded topic, too. There's a guy, I put his books on the list, James Lowen. He wrote a New York Times bestseller, which is Lies My Teacher Told Me. It was all about the history of the places, and he did another one about place names and monuments. So that's another area you can look into. And another topic I can just barely touch on, too, is some of the sports names, which are getting more press nowadays. Most particularly is the Washington Redskins, which I learned does not even just refer to the skin. It actually refers to the scalping of Native people. So that it's like this horrific thing that we have that's sort of heralded as the sports, you know, Washington Redskins. So, you know, as a Jewish person, I kind of joke. I can make the joke. It's like, would I like there to be a team called, you know, the New York, Big Noses or something like that? Schnozes. I actually did look up online. I was telling a Native person about that. I looked up online. There was actually a picture of I don't know if it was, well, I'm connected with Jimmy Durante, but it was some kind of sports logo actually with a big nose. I forget when it was. You want to mention? Yeah, it's a loaded topic. I mean, I haven't read up on it a lot, but from the little that I've heard, I think they were planning to change it, and then they didn't. I mean, it could be, you know, whoever's the sort of head of the team or the corporation could have some say into it. Maybe not enough people complaining. I'm not sure the exact answer.
It's also a history. If you root for a team, your father and grandfather,
yeah,
there's a change the name.
There's a whole
family.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sort of like these traditions that
exactly.
Again. So, you know, that's like in general part of what I'm trying to raise awareness about is that they have these sort of overlay of things put on, and, you know, some of them may be okay, some of them we have to live with, but some, you know, if we can change whether the names get changed, at least some of the awareness and consciousness to have a deeper respect for all the peoples, I think would help us. And, you know, that's obviously a big task, but we have to start somewhere.
With the Cincinnati Reds,
I never thought of that one.
Well,
I'm not sure the Reds, where that comes from.
No, I don't know where it came from, but this is the era of anti-communism.
Oh.
So apparently in the 50s they changed their name from the Cincinnati Reds to the Cincinnati Red Lakes.
Red Lights?
The Red Lakes.
Red Lakes.
L-E-G-S.
Red Legs. Oh, I get you.
Yes. So Cincinnati Reds, because of the anti-communist environment, they changed their name to...
Amazing. That's amazing. I want to touch also on Long Island a little bit. From what I've learned, there's three names for Long Island. One is, most people know, a lot of poets know, Pamunok. Because Walt Whitman was born on Long Island, he wrote poems starting from Pamunok, and he mentions that in his works. Now, when I looked that one up, the name is given Land of Tribute, which is that there was, I think, like weaker Native peoples were sort of paying like a tax to stronger ones to protect them. So, you know, even amongst Native peoples, even though there's a lot more of a history of peacefulness, you know, still some conflicts. But so there's that name, and then there's another one, Mattawak, M-A-T-O-U-A-C, young men or young warriors. And then my preferred one is, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, there's a high school like Sewanika, or I've seen it, I saw it from a Shinnecock in a book spelled out Siwan-Hak-He with a hyphen between each of the four, Siwan-Hak-He, so four phrases, whatever. And that one is my favorite because it means shell place or shell heaven. Because that's a connection to, you know, the natural elements, and it's not a tax thing, it's just a respect for the land and the water and what was here already here. So that helps me remember, you know, where we are. This book by Evan T. Pritchard is an excellent book, Native New Yorkers. And that goes into a lot of detail about New York, the city area, and also there's a few chapters on Long Island. And it's chock full of information, and that's where some of the information that I just mentioned is from. And one of the things that it reminds is that a lot of places, there may be a tree or a lot of the roadways that we take or the paths that we take, Montauk Highway. What's the one like around exit 53, Sacticos. Yeah, so, you know, usually if I'm going to visit a friend or I have an event or I'm going to a library, a lot of times I'm like, I bring out the book and I'm like, what's the name of where I'm going? Because I want to connect with something. I think Sacticos is black soil, if I remember correctly. So I want, at least it's a tidbit, but I want to learn something about what the energy of the place is, you know, that goes back from there. So this book is chock full, and you know, a lot of the roadways that we're still traveling on, which is interesting to think about, that, you know, where you may be walking down a lane that has a huge history of, you know, people, places, even trees. He'll name some trees in this book that are in certain points that maybe that was a tree where natives gather around for councils, things like that. I always wondered about why you see like a whole bunch of birds, you know, like in a mall area on telephone wires, that kind of thing. Like, why are they there? Why aren't they out by the trees? And then he has another book called Bird Medicine, and he says that like some sacred areas where maybe they had spiritual ceremonies, the birds may have gathered there, and so they're still gathering there. So these, you know, these are just interesting. I find those interesting things to kind of enter, give a different look on you know, places that we are. Another kind of generic overview book I just read recently is by Jack Weatherford, who is not native. That's another thing too. Sometimes, you know, a book may be by a native or not by a native is a big difference. But this one I've heard get good recommendations, called Indian Givers, and it goes over amazing amount of, we're talking about the words that are part of the language. It goes chapter by chapter from architecture, medicine, foods, technology, all kinds of things that go back, you know, that it shows the, like, a higher sense of learning and science of Native people. So there's multiple, again, as I'm touching on all these topics, there's multiple ways, if you have any interest in this, that you can explore things, whether it's historically or culturally or just picking one topic or one state. Yeah?
I was wondering about the burial ground.
Yeah, I mean, that's understandable. That just recently I'm into golf. I watch golf. I like following golf. And that was a super loaded topic recently with the U.S. Open. One of the most famous courses in the whole country, it's considered one of the best courses, is Shinnecock Hills. And that's Shinnecock, they say that's built, part of that is on Indian burial, part of their burial grounds. So that's a, you know, that's a whole loaded topic right there. Let's see, I'll read, okay, let's see, which do you want to hear, the one about New York or Georgia? New York? See, I'm pandering to the crowd here. Wow, it got, oh yeah, it was supposed to have a rainstorm, so all of a sudden it got quite dark in here. All right, now when I looked up New York, the two things that I found, which I mentioned in the first stanza, is one says it was from a Duke of York, a place, and that means a wild boar, as in a pig. And the other one mentioned a yew tree, Y-E-W, a tree that might have been on an estate. So I don't know the exact answer. And I'm only going to read, this is a really long section because I got into the, as I mentioned before, the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Nation is five or six nations now, the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, I forget them all off the top of my head. So that's upstate New York. That was a big influence on the Constitution. But I want to read the lead up to that. The 11th state, 1788. New York, from English, for a Duke of York and Albany. Probably from British York, wild boar or estate with yew tree. First, New Netherland and Amsterdam with mountains and islands. Then skyscrapers, finance, Broadway, Statue of Liberty. That Duke, James Stuart, also Earl of Ulster, of the lineage of Kings Charles and James of Bible translation. Duke, a title going back to Rome and bearing a monarch and military affiliation. Then affecting New York, New Jersey, the Carolinas, and Maryland, with namesakes and prestige to strike up the band. Peter Minuit dealt for New York with tribes with whom fair trading was busy. Beaver pelts and wampum for European goods, the start of the industrious city. The British took New Amsterdam, including a wall to keep the Lenape out, from then anti-Semite Peter Stuyvesant and the Dutch. On Wall Street, what was once a slave market, now a stock market, but at least the low-income slave workers, except in pockets, they can't touch. As a vital port of entry to New York, who could best do the manual labor? Blacks, whites, mulattoes, and Indians for the shipping biz then in favor. When a British assault on New York in 1776, many black slaves were defense, though many had joined the Brits. And George Washington, strong with 18,000 soldiers at the Battle of Long Island, then retreated to Manhattan, and after 6 years of war and British control, only then, 1781, with a promise, was slavery defeated. On July 4th of 1827, a proclamation of no slavery, though it wasn't until 1841 that the proclamation manifested its bravery. And except for some slaves coming in on some ships, it was 1865 before the law was fully polished. It took a civil war, 600,000 killed, and a 13th Amendment to have slavery abolished. And a large population of Jewish people escaping from Nazi incarceration, plus many Italian, Irish, and European, Asian, Hispanic, Latino, and others now call this land their nation. But before all of that, before the big sell, Lenape Hocking, the dwelling place of the Lenape, where the ordinary people dwell. And before all of that, before the tallest skyscrapers scaled by Mohawk were seen, there were villages and pathways, and yes, even Manhattan once grassy green. Remember the Delaware? Make that the Lenape, and the truth you will tell of the first inhabitants, pre-Columbian, pre-concrete, nobody special, where the ordinary people dwell. New York, home to the League of Iroquois Nations, in their own tongue, Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse, originators of the great law of peace, and, like the Cherokee and others, a matrilineal society headed by the matriarchal spouse. I can barely read because it's getting so dark. That's all right, because I think I won't read any more for now. So we got a few more minutes. Anybody have a question or? I think that's a Spanish. I think one of them they give is allies or there's a. Let me look. Oh yeah, you wanted to know Maine and Texas, right? Let me see. Thank you. let me come out here a little bit. M-A-Y-N-E. I think it's Spanish, and there's a native.
On the left hand side.
This is what it was like hundreds of years ago. That's good. Here's my number. Oh, wow. Thank you. Okay, Texas. So there's a book I read a while ago that was called, actually, you think every time I email someone I say it's not a typo, it's called the untied states of America, I think it's called, the untied states, because actually recently there was California was talking about seceding. I think in New Hampshire there's been talk about secession or forming their own governments. So I don't know. It's an interesting idea. It's an interesting topic. But again, there's this whole kind of consciousness of United States. But you know, I think it's a sort of like a Zen koan. How united are they? How united are the states, and is that the direction we're going in, where there is this bringing together of all the states, or are they splintering? You know, are we going to have separate countries in a little while, and you know, so many years, and how does that interrelate with you know, the native peoples? And obviously now, obviously the U.S. is a multicultural mix. So, you know, like I said, I don't have a lot of answers, but this is kind of just trying to stir up, you know, what I think is worth thinking about. And, you know, if anything, my answer is to try to learn something about, you know, the original peoples here, whether you actually meet someone or you read a book and or see a movie or listen to a song, whatever.
California, I have a theory like that. I think Spanish,
when I looked that up, there were so many, it was quite confusing.
Say Texas is pre-Spanish.
Yeah, Tejas, take allies or friends.
No, I was just kidding.
But again, like I said, yeah, again, it's like, take it with a grain of salt. Like, my Lakota friend, his name's Teokasin Ghost Horse, he's the host of the radio show. And, you know, the name given for the Dakotas, North and South Dakota, is Allies. And he said he went to his elders and said, is that what the name means? And they were like, no, it doesn't mean that. So, I mean, Allies is nice, at least it's a positive thing, but... Amazing. Well, they, you know, there could be some communities being built up. That's a whole history lesson, too. The main reason they're so poor is because the U.S. Goes back to, like, treaties made in 1868, around 1868. I think there was the Treaty of Fort Laramie, maybe, to get along with the Lakota, and then they discovered gold. So that was one of about the 400 treaties made with the natives that the U.S. has not kept a one of them. So they went into the hills, and now so the whole gold, that's a whole chapter of history. But basically, the Lakota people refused to, you know, sell their land. They've been offered billions of dollars for their land. Standing Rock, that's a whole issue. But the hills, the point, again, that kind of wrapping up, that ties back to part of why they're so poor, because that, you know, they didn't sell out. They haven't sold out, and they're not, you know, going to, because the land is sacred and the land is part of the culture, and the land has memory. That's another quote I put on the flyer from a native book I'm reading, where the way I can relate to it is like you think about your backyard, you know, quote your backyard, where I'm at, there was a lilac I rent, and the first owner, for some reason, he wanted to cut out the lilac, took out the lilac tree. And I love lilac, so. But, you know, when I sit out in the yard during the day or at night, whether I'm having coffee or a glass of wine, I look over there and I'll think of the lilac. And I wrote a poem about the lilacs. So it's like, you know, I have a memory from just being there, only 18 or so years, being in that one little yard. I have a memory of, you know, different places where things are. So if you take that and expand that to, you know, 700 native peoples who have been here for thousands of years, and you realize the land has a memory and stories that are part of the culture itself. So, you know, just trying to, you know, to say, well, here's better conditions, or here's your condo, or here's your, you know, now are you happy? It's like that may help some people live comfortably, but there's a deep spiritual connection with the land and all the, you know, again, the water, the air, all those things that are, you know, part of the story.
No one owns the land. Chief Seattle,
exactly,
I remember, said that the land is everybody. No one, there's no ownership.
Yeah, I mean, people. Yeah, I think it's familiar in our, you know, our culture. I don't know if there's any. I don't recognize if there's anybody who's native here. You know, raise your hand. But I think we're, you know, we're well aware of these things, but they kind of get, you know, off to the side sometimes. What was I just gonna say? That one of the key things I've learned over the years, another book on here, excellent book by a guy I got to meet, Stephen Newcomb. It's called Pagans in the Promised Land. And it talks about what's called the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, which was actual legal papal bulls in the 1400s. They are, and they still shape the judicial system today. And basically, they gave the colonists coming over here legal authority to take the land, because the basic doctrine states that any lands that were not inhabited by Christians were considered terra nullis, which means nobody is on there. Yeah, from papal bull. Yep.
They had the right to say.
Yeah, it's part of the legal system today. It still affects court. It's maybe that's a key thing that when I follow native stuff, that people are trying to have the Pope, like Pope Francis is much more open-minded nowadays. They're like trying to get him to not just apologize, but to change that whole structure, because that would affect the whole legal system. Certain court cases are decided about like whose land it is based on court cases. So that, again, the history goes way back, but it sometimes literally affects, what's going on. I'm trying to find Maine, and then we're just about out of time. Even I'm happy to stay a little longer if you want to talk. Maine. Is that a French one? Oh, I have it under English. Let me find out why. Let's see. Possibly after the mainland called Maine, or French province Maine, M-A-Y-N-E, most likely from an English town, Maine, the ancestral home of colonizer Sir Ferdinando Gorges, G-O-R-G-E-S. Broad Maine and Parva Maine, M-A-E-N, towns large and small, were named after the split of his ancestral land. Province of Maine. So yeah, again, there's a lot of times you can see like, I just go to look it up, and then I'm like an hour later I'm thinking, what's the answer?
Because nobody really knows.
Well, yeah, I think in some of them there that you can know, and like again, some of the names, if they're specifically from Native people, you'd have to go to a Native people who knows the history to say, this is what it's named after. That's another loaded topic, because a lot the stories are of the Bering Strait, but what I've heard from a lot of Native peoples is that they are from here. No, I'm sorry.
Archaeology and anthropology.
Right, but those again, that, those are sciences. But when you have a oral tradition going back thousands of years, I tend to you have to, it depends on each people, but like the Lakota have memory, they have, their traditions are from here. Their origin story is like from a cave, And that, I had even read in another book I put on there called Iroquois Fire. In the first chapter, it's mostly about the modern Mohawk and the whole Canada, New York kind of conflict that went on and still going on. But he mentions that at the time that they say the Bering Strait, it would have been like ice up to there. Like there was actually no physical way to get over there.
How did they get?
So they came by water. They came by boat.
That's
all. Well, how did anybody get to? See, this gets into a philosophical discussion, because how did anybody first get to Earth? So, but when you have people there, some of their people say they are from here. Literally from here. So that, you have to look, you have to get into history and not just archaeology, but some of their own, their stories and what their migration, some of the migration routes, some of them maybe came from the south or from the north. So that's like 20,000 years back. History is like barely.
The question, what happened to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Anasazi too. There's a lot of mysteries. I think nowadays there's so much dispersion that the world has got, even a lot of Native people, they are part French, part this, part that. So there's much more, because it's easier to travel and get places, and the breeding. I think over the years that's going to change even more with the globalness of the world. There's going to be much more different mix, whatever you call it, mixed breed, whatever. So the actual sort of traditional things become like treasures. I mean, you know, once in a while I learn, I don't know if anybody knows, wonderful poet and a friend just passed away. She lived in Great Neck, Muriel Harris Weinstein. And she wrote a bunch of poems about growing up and hearing Yiddish at the dinner table. You know, and I would read those poems, and it was like I didn't grow up with that, you know, kind of upbringing, but it was like a little treasure from a piece of my own tradition, and it seems like that gets, you know, thinner and thinner as the years go on, so, which is, you know, sad in its way, but so it sometimes does take, you know, plowing through books or, you know, finding sometimes the right person to talk to, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. But, you know, if you find the right person or, well, usually it's off the beaten path where somebody knows somebody, you know, somebody is connected to a tradition that has a lineage, and they may know closer to, you know, first person. All right, thank you so much for being
thank
here. Thank you very much. And like I said, there's also the books are $10 if you want to read about all the states and more. Oh, and I was going to mention, I meant to say I'm speaking a foreign language, because I realized that the other day, like, this is the foreign language here. We always think of foreigners as like people from Russia and Asia. Oh, he's speaking a foreign language. And then I hear, you know, native people talk about language, and like there's languages from this land. So we're the ones speaking a foreign language. Interestingly, yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, thanks. Appreciate it.